With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the A to Z of David Bowie. I'm Mark Riley, and that colourful character is Rob Hughes. And we've got a special announcement, haven't we, Bob?
We have, Mark. So, to start, thank you for taking so much interest in our journey through the life of David Bowie. It's a long and winding road.
That's the Beatles, not Bowie, Bob.
It's a long and winding road, but we don't look back in anger.
Oasis?
We look back in anger.
That's more like it.
Oh, shut up.
Anyway, we've got some news for you.
As you'll be aware, the A to Z of David Bowie is free to download.
Lunacy.
But if you'd like to support us along the way and be a member of an exclusive Bowie club, you can. And here's how.
There's an exclusive Bowie members club called Cheap Things. And for just $5 a month, wow, you can be part of it.
Why? So now you're thinking $5 isn't much, but what exactly will I get for my hard-earned cash?
Well, in short, you'll get lots of great new exclusive material delivered to your door.
Well, computer, actually, Mark.
Via a system called Patreon.
That's right, Mark. Patreon is a payment system that allows you to contribute your monthly subscription and offers you a portal to access the exclusive material.
Material such as
interviews with Bowie's cohorts and friends.
There'll be regular film Bowie quizzes.
Bowie guitar tutorials.
Unreleased archive written material.
Competitions.
And perhaps most impressively, short films featuring the Cheap Things team.
Ah, that'll be me, Mark, Howard Knock and Jason Reed.
Visiting various Bowie places of interest.
And much more besides.
All this for just $5 a month.
So if you can't resist, simply go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/cheapthings, or one word, and join up.
There's also a website,
bowiecheapthings.com.
Book early. S is for, well, there's two here actually, Bob. Station to Station, one of the greatest albums ever made.
Oh, indeed. It's the 10th album, in fact, by Bowie, released by RCA in 1976. Commonly regarded as one of his most significant works, it was the vehicle for his performance persona, the Thin White Duke.
More of which later.
Yeah.
So the album was recorded after he completed shooting Nick Rogue's The Man Who Fell to Earth, and the cover artwork featured a still from the movie. During the sessions, Bowie was heavily dependent on drugs, especially cocaine, and later claimed that he recalled almost nothing of the production.
Musically, Station to Station was a transitional album for Bowie, developing the funk and soul music of his previous album, Young Americans, whilst also moving towards synthesizers and motoric rhythms influenced by German electronic bands like Neu and Kraftwerk. So this trend, of course, would culminate in some of his most acclaimed work, the so-called Berlin Trilogy.
It was a confused period in his life, wasn't it?
It was very much so, wasn't it? And, you know, he always said in interviews that he didn't remember making this, which can't really be true, but I think it was a way of him just deflecting questions about that era, because I know, you know, it was such a difficult time for him, wasn't it, on a personal level?
Well, we'll talk about the Thin White Duke and exactly who that was in a short while, I think. But I do remember there was a quote from Bowie saying that the only thing that he remembered from the sessions was lying under a desk and shouting to Earl Slick, do the Chuck Berry riff at the end of Station to Station. But anyway, Bowie himself said that Station to Station was a plea to come back to Europe for me. The album's lyrics reflected his preoccupations with Friedrich Nietzsche, Aleister Crowley, mythology and religion. So, preceded by the single Golden Years, Station to Station made the top five in both the UK and US charts. By January 2017, the album had sold over 4.5 million units worldwide. I've got 7 of those copies.
Oh, get lot. I've probably got about 4.
There you go.
Anyway, let's get to the background, shall we? So, according to Bowie's biographer, David Buckley, the LA-based Bowie, fueled by an astronomic cocaine habit and subsisting on a diet of peppers and milk, spent much of 1975 and 76 in a state of psychic terror, Stories, mostly from one interview, pieces of which found their way into Playboy and Rolling Stone, circulated of the singer living in a house full of ancient Egyptian artifacts, burning black candles, seeing bodies fall past his window, having his semen stolen by witches, receiving secret messages from the Rolling Stones, and living in morbid fear of fellow Aleister Crowley aficionado Jimmy Page.
So, there's I tell you what, there is a biopic in that one paragraph, Bob.
There is indeed. Also, what I didn't mention there was the fact that at one point, I think he had his swimming pool exercised, didn't he?
Supposedly. Yeah. And I wonder if the message from the Rolling Stones was from Mick Jagger saying, "Yeah, David, stop nicking my ideas, will you?" That was quite good for
that
me.
That was incredible. That would terrify you, wouldn't it? Really would, yeah. Let's face it.
Bowie would later say of L.A., that flipping place should be wiped off the face of the earth. He really didn't like his stay there, did he? And I don't know if we're going to get into this at any point in here, but it was Glenn Hughes' house from Deep Purple that he stayed in, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. I mean, Glenn Hughes wasn't looking after himself well either at that time, was he? He's probably not the best person to hang out with.
I think it's like a great episode of Stella Street, isn't it? Can you imagine? Let's see, you got Bowie in there with like his urine supposedly in the fridge with a priest having a go at his swimming pool, you know? And then Glenn Hughes comes back and goes, "Oh, David, what's going on in here? Look at the mess. What's this in the fridge?"
I'd pay to watch that.
I fancy something to eat. What have I got? Well, I've got the option of some green peppers, some milk, or some urine. It's not a good night, is
not
it?
Not really, well.
Anyway, it was on the set of his first major film, so not including The Image then.
No.
The Man Who Fell to Earth, that Bowie began writing a pseudo-autobiography called The Return of the Thin White Duke. He was also composing music on the understanding that he wrote to provide for the film's soundtrack. Though this didn't happen in the end, at Bowie's recommendation, John Phillips of the Mamas and Papas would write and produce all the original music for the film instead, as we know. It was released quite recently again on vinyl, wasn't it? And I bought it.
I bought it too. Yeah. Director Nicholas Roeg warned the star that the part of Thomas Jerome Newton would likely remain with him for some time after production completed on the film. With Roeg's agreement, Bowie developed his own look for the film, and this carried through to his public image. And also, you know, he must have really stayed with him because it carried on to two album covers immediately afterwards, didn't it?
Station
and Low. The Thin White Duke became the mouthpiece for Station to Station and often during the next 6 months for Bowie himself, impeccably dressed in white shirt, black trousers and waistcoat. The Duke was an aloof character who sang songs of agonised intensity, yet felt nothing, or ice masquerading as fire, as somebody once called him.
Yeah, and just going back to the covers that we're talking about, Station to Station and the ensuing Low. Mm. It's funny how iconic Low is as an album cover, because you look at it and it shouldn't be a great album cover, really, for what it is. It's a still from a film. He's wearing a duffel coat.
Yeah.
You know, it's not ideal.
It's not really.
I've got a duffel coat, and people don't stop and look at me when I'm just stood there on the tram stop.
Well, maybe if you stared wistfully over a lake, you know, in the winter, they might do, but unlikely.
Unlikely, but the thing is that, I don't know if you saw this, but quite recently there was a photograph, a promo shot of Jodie Whittaker for Doctor Who, and it looked like an absolute replica of Low.
Oh, really?
I know we're talking Station to Station here, but we're talking about the same period of, cinematography and stills taken from the film. But it is iconic, and we'll get to the cover of Station to Station a little bit later on.
We will.
Okay, so the Thin White Duke persona has also been described as a mad aristocrat, an amoral zombie, an emotionless Aryan Superman. For Bowie himself, the Duke was a nasty character indeed. Now, I'm just wondering, Bob, you know, how much of this is Bowie's displeasure with himself? Okay, so at this point in time, he wasn't looking after himself, as we've just said, and he'd fallen out with nearly everybody, hadn't he?
Yeah, he had.
Coco, omnipresent.
Yeah, of course.
Iggy Pop, around about this time, is soul buddy, you know, and we know that Jeff McCormack, War and Peace also. Mm. But most other people have gone by the wayside, so his relationship with Angie was tetchy.
Yeah.
He's also been through the rigmarole with Tony DeFries.
Yeah.
He'd fallen out with all of the spiders.
Mm.
And he had a bad drug habit. He must have really had a little bit of displeasure with the way his life was going at that point in time. So you wonder if the Thin White Duke, and Bowie often hid behind his characters, didn't he?
Yeah, of course.
You're just wondering if the Thin White Duke, this persona, was actually, in a way, David Bowie, and him looking at himself and thinking, I'm a mess, because he ran away from all of that lifestyle shortly afterwards, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Well, the interesting thing is about, you know, when you look at the contemporary interviews of Bowie around that time, at no point does he say, you know, I'm unhappy. You know, he talked a lot about kind of giving up rock and roll, didn't he, for a long time?
Yeah.
But, you know, at the time, he was always talking up the Thin White Duke character as this positive thing in his life. And he's, I know he had to because he was on tour, so he would be doing that anyway. It was only in retrospect that he looked back and didn't really have a lot of great things to say about it. That's when he started calling himself, yeah, I was a nasty character, I was aloof and all this stuff. So you see this in hindsight, don't you? At the time, as you say, you know, it's something that he was just, it was convenient for him to hide behind for a bit.
And also, I mean, at this point in time, he had the opportunity to make some money. That's how he saw it. And he had been kind of involved in some dodgy contracts, which really didn't give him the fruits of his labour. And so he'd come out the other side of the thing with Tony DeFries. He was probably looking forward to actually getting his hands on some money. But at that point in time, he had nobody around him that he could really look at, you know, as an example of steering him in the right direction. Was it David Lipman? Was it the
guy called Michael Lipman, wasn't
Michael
it?
Michael Lipman.
But I think that was kind of a very, very difficult relationship as well. He was having a few falling outs with him. That was the thing. There didn't seem to be anybody around him that had his best interests at heart.
Apart from Coco.
Yeah, so you can understand the paranoia that's kind of, you know, fed into this character.
Yeah.
It's like magnified from Bowie himself.
Okay, so Station to Station was recorded in late 1975 at Cherokee Studios in LA. Okay, and in 1981, Enemy editors Roy Carr and Charles Shaw Murray, we often say that, but it's a book that they did together, so we don't know who did which bit, suggested that it was made in 10 days of feverish activity when Bowie decided there was no hope of his producing a soundtrack for The Man Who Fell to Earth.
However, later on it came to light that the album was recorded over a couple of months, with the sessions beginning in late September or early October 75 and ending in late November. So in other words, it was done before Bowie began his abortive sessions on the soundtrack. At various times, it was to be called The Return of the Thin White Duke or Golden Years. Station to Station was co-produced by Harry Maslin, who's Bowie's associate, of course, for Fame and Across the Universe on Young Americans.
So Tony Visconti, who after a three-year absence had recently returned to the Bowie fold, mixing Diamond Dogs and co-producing David Live and Young Americans, was not involved due to competing schedules. However, the record did cement the band lineup that would see Bowie through the rest of the decade, with bassist George Murray joining Young Americans drummer Dennis Davis and rhythm guitarist Carlos Alomar.
Well, this is crucial, isn't it, this?
Yeah.
So the recording process developed with this team set the pattern for Bowie's albums up to and including Scary Monsters in 1980. Backing tracks laid down by Murray, Davis and Alomar, saxophone, keyboard and lead guitar overdubs, here by Bowie, Roy Bittan and Earl Slick, respectively, lead vocals and finally various production tricks to just complete the whole thing.
Okay, so according to Bowie, this is a quote, "I got some quite extraordinary things out of Earl Slick. I think it captured his imagination to make noises on guitar and textures rather than playing the right notes." Alomar recalled, "It was one of the most glorious albums that I've ever done. We experimented so much on it."
Yeah, Harry Maslin said, "I loved those sessions because we were totally open and experimental in our approach." Bowie himself remembered almost nothing of the album's production, as we mentioned, not even the studio, later admitting, "I know it was in LA because I've read it was." The singer was not alone in his use of cocaine during the sessions, Carlos Alomar commenting, "If there's a line of coke which is going to keep you awake until 8 a.m. so you can do your guitar part, well, you do the line of coke. The coke use is driven by the inspiration." We've talked about this before, haven't we? You know, it wasn't just a recreational thing. It was a means for Bowie to keep on working while the iron was hot.
Yeah, I mean, and other people have done it as well. No, you experiment with drugs and you see where it takes you. But this is in a professional kind of mode, isn't it? Mm. So you're doing it and you're pushing yourself, almost using yourself as a guinea pig.
Yeah.
To see how much your body can take and where it will take you.
Yeah, how long you can stay awake.
Absolutely. Okay, so here we go. Like Bowie, Earl Slick had somewhat vague memories of the recording. That album's a little fuzzy for the obvious reasons. We were in the studio and it was nuts. Lots of hours and lots of late nights. In 2017, Carlos Alomar recalled to Rolling Stone, "When we were in work mode, it was always about the work. If it was fueled by coke or whatever, David was always able to manage the decision making, and it was always about the same concern for him. What are the lyrics and what am I going to talk about?"
Yeah, he continued, "That professionalism was what enabled us to keep going. He would write something, express something, get to work and let's make the donuts." Great phrase.
Right.
From the same article in Rolling Stone, Earl Slick told of how Bowie's feverish working methods meant that musicians got used to being called into the studio at any time of day or night. He said, "I remember one night we didn't even have the studio booked and I was at the Rainbow Bar and Grill."
And he said, "As we used to say, I was under the weather. Suddenly, one of the roadies comes in. They search the whole place and find me at a back table. He says, 'Time to go to work.' I say, 'It's 1 in the morning and I'm drunk.' And he said, 'That's okay. David's at the studio. There's a a car outside, so I paid my tab, jumped in the car, and worked all night. I mean, that was not an unusual thing to happen.
It's a great image, that, isn't it? You know, yeah. What state he was in when he got there. Pianist Roy Bittan's involvement in the sessions was pretty spontaneous too. Again, this is from Rolling Stone in 2017. He says, I was staying at the Sunset Marquee in Los Angeles when we, meaning the E Street Band with Springsteen, of course, were on the Born to Run tour in 1975. I bumped into Earl Slick at the hotel and he said, I can't believe you're here. We were just talking about you. And when I arrived the next day at the studio, David said to me, do you know who Professor Longhair is?
I said, know him. I saw him play at a little roadhouse in Houston about 3 weeks ago. I wound up doing an imitation of Professor Longhair interpreting a David Bowie song. We began with TVC 15, and I wound up playing on every song besides Wild Is the Wind. It's one of my favourite projects that I ever worked on. And I never thought about that. I was wondering where that piano came from. And, you know, you try and place it and think where it might have been lifted from. Definitely Professor Longhair, you know,
New Orleans jazz
and all that. Yeah, completely.
Of course, as we know, Roy Bittan went on to play on Ashes to Ashes as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
The sleeve front cover used a black and white still from The Man Who Fell to Earth, in which Bowie, as the character Thomas Jerome Newton, steps into the space capsule that will return him to his home planet.
Bowie had insisted on the cropped black and white image, as he felt that in the original colour full-sized image, the sky looked artificial. When Ryko Disc reissued Bowie's catalogue in the early 90s, the colour version was used. The back cover showed Bowie sketching the Kabbalah Sephirot, is it? With chalk, something he had been doing on the set of the film. Now, you know, the original cover artwork...
Yes.
There were some made up, and they sold on eBay, and they go for thousands of pounds. And there was also a bootleg version of it, which was sold on eBay, like actually made up, because the other ones were just like the flat piece, you know, the artwork.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
With all the cut lines on it. But somebody made an actual bootleg of the sleeve, all made up, and I bought one. And that's really collectible as well.
Yeah, wow,
it's strange. Okay. And I've also got in that cover, I've got a white label of Station to Station.
Have you really?
I have, yeah. Ooh, which, and do you know what? I mean, it is crazy, and I hate even to say it, but I forgot I had it. I was looking through all the stuff, and I pulled it out, and I thought, oh, yeah, that's that bootleg cover. And I pulled, and I thought, well, there's a record in it. And I pulled it out, and it is a proper, legit Station to Station test pressing. And I sent a photograph of it to Mark Adams, davidbowie.com, and he went, yeah, I remember you buying it.
Oh, right, okay.
So he's got a memory, and I haven't.
Fair enough. Where did you buy that from, just incidentally?
On eBay. I got it on eBay. Right. But also, just want to mention at this point in time, and it has been said before, but apparently the idea for the cover of Station to Station being black and white and being very plain, Bowie saw Dr. Feelgood's Down by the Jetty.
That's right, yes, that's right, which has the same kind of thing, doesn't it? You know, the black-white image in a box.
It's very, very similar. Yeah, okay. Worth mentioning.
Anyway, to styles and themes now of Station to Station, often cited as a transitional album for Bowie, as I mentioned, Nicholas Pegg in The Complete David Bowie called it a precise halfway point on the journey from young Americans to low. Enemy pair Roy Carr and Charles Shaw Murray, again, wrote that it effectively divides the 70s for Bowie. It ties off the era of Ziggy Stardust and Plastic Soul and introduces the first taste of the new music that was to follow with Low.
Indeed, in terms of Bowie's own output, Station to Station showed the influence of krautrock and electronic music by bands like Neu, Can and Kraftwerk. Thematically, the album revisited concepts dealt with in songs such as The Superman from The Man Who Sold the World, Quicksand from Hunky Dory, Nietzsche's Overman, The Occultism with Aleister Crowley, Nazi Fascination with Grail Mythology and The Kabbalah.
Yeah,
there's plenty going on there. It's a cocktail, that, isn't it?
It is. Deep themes. The musical style of Golden Years, the first track recorded for the album, built on the funk and soul of young Americans with a harsher edge, you might say, has been described as carrying with it an air of regret for missed opportunities and past pleasures. Bowie said it was written for and rejected by Elvis Presley. We've mentioned this, haven't we? Well, Bowie's then-wife Angie claimed it was written for her.
Well, I thought it was written for me. Though a top 10 single on both sides of the Atlantic, Golden Years was rarely performed live on the subsequent Isolar tour. Stay was another riff-driven funk piece, recorded very much in our cocaine frenzy, according to Carlos Alomar.
Now, the Christian element of the album was most obvious in the hymn-like Word on a Wing. Bowie himself has claimed that in this song, at least, the passion is genuine. When performing it live in 1999, the singer described it as coming from the darkest days of my life. I'm sure, actually, it was a call for help.
It's a wonderful song.
Yeah.
Well, as is the closing ballad, Wild Is the Wind, was the album's sole cover, and had been praised as one of the finest vocal performances of Bowie's career. Bowie was inspired to record it after he met the singer-pianist-songwriter Nina Simone, whose version is on her self-titled album of 1966. So I play her version as well.
Yeah.
It's around about 6 minutes long also. I play it on the Six Music programme. But Bowie's performance on that is right up there with Sweet Thing and Candidate.
It is.
Isn't it? It is really just absolutely magnificent.
It is. I mean, that's one of the features, for me anyway, of Station to Station. The fact, really, it's when Bowie, not that he hadn't come into his own, he came into his own vocally, I always feel, with Diamond Dogs, but Station to Station, he's really got it nailed, hasn't he? You know, Young Americans built that up, and then Station to Station is a little bit kind of more stripped away, and it's Bowie in brilliant mode, almost like Sinatra in places, you know, really crooning.
Absolutely. And the thing is that, he, you know, his voice is like a crooner. We know, you just mentioned Frank Sinatra, and he was big on Bing Crosby, as again, for better or for worse. But he started to bring out more of that kind of baritone timbre to his voice, didn't he? And so it started with, as far as I can remember anyway, with Sweet Thing and Candidate, with it, that really bold, deep, resonant voice.
Yeah.
But it's all the way through on Station to Station. It's like he'd kind of found his voice.
Yeah.
And also, you know, a lot of singers, they sing in a way which isn't good for the voice. I know that Susie Sue, she did the same thing. She sung with that real kind of baritone thing. She was a massive Bowie fan.
Yeah, of course.
And it really, really buggered up her throat.
Right.
She had to stop singing like that. You know, it's like it's not natural,
sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And so you got to learn to train your voice. So you sing how you want to sing, but eventually it can catch up with you.
Right.
And you just think that Bowie, it's not operatic, but, you know, it's getting on for.
Yeah, it is, definitely. And also, I think it just shows his confidence, because a lot of those arrangements, like Word on a Wing or Wild as the Wind, his voice is at the forefront, so there's no trickery going on. He's not trying to mask himself. You just get the impression that I know what I'm doing here and I am confident in this voice. Remember what he says about not remembering the sessions? There's a certain amount of confidence, steely confidence behind all this stuff.
Well, his voice, if you listen to Aladdin Sane, his voice is quite reedy.
Yeah, it is.
So if you compare the voice, David Bowie's voice on Aladdin Sane or Ziggy, and you compare it to Station to Station, there's a marked difference, isn't there?
There is. Huge difference, in fact. Anyway, so Bowie had met Simone in 1974 and reportedly told her, "Where you're coming from, there are very few of us out there." Simone later said of Bowie, "He's got more sense than anybody I've ever known. David ain't from here." The image of the man who fell to earth, Thomas Jerome Newton, sitting in front of dozens of TV monitors, is said to have partly inspired the album's most upbeat track, TVC15, supposedly also about Iggy Pop's girlfriend being eaten by a TV set. It has been called the most oblique tribute to the Yardbirds imaginable. I can't see the Yardbirds reference there.
No, I can't either. What did just spring to my mind then is I've been to Graceland, Elvis Presley's place, and we've all seen those photographs of his room with loads and loads of TVs in.
Yeah.
I would imagine that there's a little bit of Elvis in there as well. That only just came to me, and of course I could be wrong. I usually am.
No.
The title track has been described as heralding a new era of experimentalism for Bowie. Station to Station was in two parts, a slow, portentous piano-driven march introduced by the sound of an approaching train juxtaposed with Earl Slick's agitated guitar feedback, followed by an up-tempo rock blues section. So we know that the train bit at the beginning was inspired by Kraftwerk.
Yeah,
pretty damn directly, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The title track reflected Bowie's new interest in electronics and industrial rhythms, as in sound as texture, as he put it at the time. My favourite group is a German band, Kraftwerk. It plays noise music to increase productivity.
That's great, that, isn't it? I was just thinking, driving over, that, you know, of all the opening tracks on a Bowie album, probably Station to Station is the one that you would single out that really sets up the entire thing. Maybe it's No Game from Scary Monsters too, but when you look at like opening tracks of Bowie albums, Station to Station is the one, isn't it, really?
It is. It sends a chill, doesn't it? It's also 5 years...
Yeah, of course, of course. How can I forget that? There's that.
And then it'd be a bit like the Monty Python. What did the Romans ever do for us?
You go, Honky Dory.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But anyway, I know what you mean. It's a chilling moment. It's just absolutely brilliant.
It just sums up everything he was about at that time. Years later, in 1999, Bowie told Uncut Magazine, sadly, Mark, not me. I think this was Chris Roberts did the interview. Since Station to Station, the hybridization of R&B and electronics had been a goal of mine. Despite the noise of a train in the opening moments, Bowie says that the title refers not so much to railway stations as to the stations of the cross, while the line from Kithir to Malkuth relates to mystical places in the Kabbalah, mixing Christian and Jewish allusions.
Fixation with the occult was further evident in such phrases as White Stains, the name of the book of poetry by Aleister Crowley. The lyrics also gave notice of Bowie's recent drug use. It's not the side effects of the cocaine, I'm thinking that it must be love. I'm not even being funny here. I mean, I was, like, you know, 15 at the time.
Yes.
But I thought he was cooking.
Oh, Mark.
No. I mean, I'm hoping that everybody at home is... They're probably saying, what a dickhead. But I'm hoping just a couple of them are going, oh, bless.
Yeah.
Oh, bless you, Mark. But I did. I thought, not the side effects of the cooking. in.
Oh, that would be a whole different album, wouldn't it? Yeah.
It would. With its krautrock influence, it was the album's clearest foretaste of Bowie's subsequent Berlin trilogy. Speaking to Cream magazine in 1977, Bowie proclaimed that Station to Station was devoid of spirit. Even the love songs are detached, but I think it's fascinating.
Every song on Station to Station eventually appeared on a single. Golden Years was released in November 75, 2 months before the album came out. Bowie allegedly got drunk to perform it on TV for the American show Soul Train. He looks like he is, isn't he?
Yeah, he's away with the fairies, yeah.
One of my favourite clips of Bowie, resulting in the film clip seen on music video programmes. It got to number 8 in the UK, number 10 in the US, where it stayed for 16 weeks. The title track was released as a promo 7-inch single in January 76, the single exclusively released in France, and featured a shortened version of the track, lasting just over 3.5 minutes, which really is sacrilege. You shouldn't be tampering with that.
It's not right, that, is it? TVC 15 was released in edited form as a second single in May 1976, reaching number 33 in the UK, number 64 in the States. Stay, also shortened, and appearing on the same month, was issued as a companion 45 to RCA's Changes One Bowie Greatest Hits collection, though perversely, it didn't appear on the album.
No, it didn't. Bizarre. And it's got the same sleeve, hasn't it? It's got that picture sleeve.
Weird.
In November 81, as Bowie's relationship with RCA was winding down, Wild as the Wind was issued as a single to push the Changes to Bowie comp. Backed with Word on a Wing and accompanied by a video shot especially for the release, it got to number 24 in the UK.
Another song recorded during the album sessions at Cherokee Studios, supposedly a cover of Bruce Springsteen's It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City, which went unreleased at the time but was issued on the 1989 Sound and Vision box set. It's funny because I'm also there is a box set of this which has got a big wooden frame on it.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it, yeah.
It's worth quite a lot of money. And I haven't got it.
I've
got
to say.
No, I haven't got it. But I have had a back and forth with Mark Adams quite a lot about this. We used to wind him up because whenever I talk about anything that I had that he didn't have, which is, let's face it, is not much.
Yeah.
He would say, yeah, but have you got the Sound of Vision with the, you know, the big wooden frame box? I'm going, it's crap that, mate. I won't give it house space. I used to tell him that I could go down to B&Q, buy some timber, knock one up myself if I could be bothered, but I simply couldn't.
Oh.
But obviously, there's a deep-rooted jealousy there.
Of course.
I mean, because it's a rare piece, but not only that, and it's worth a fortune.
Harry Maslin and Carlos Alomar have claimed that they never recorded the song, the Springsteen song, during the Cherokee sessions, while Tony Visconti believes the song most likely consisted of overdubs to a track originally cut at Olympic and Island Studios during the Diamond Dogs sessions, with Ainsley Dunbar on drums, Herbie Flowers on bass, and Mike Garson on keyboards.
Worth ringing up Herbie Flowers and finding out, actually.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
So the reception to Station, Billboard considered that Bowie had found his musical niche following songs like Fame and Golden Years, but that the 10-minute title cut drags
him off it.
What?
What? What? What? The Enemy, meanwhile, called it one of the most significant albums released in the last 5 years, later naming it the second greatest album of the year. Wasn't the first Desire by Dylan?
Well, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. They were wrong. Rolling Stone's Terry Morris applauded the album's rockier moments, but discerned a move away from the genre, finding it, in quotes here, the thoughtfully professional effort of a style-conscious artist whose ability to write and perform demanding rock and roll exists comfortably alongside his fascination for diverse forms. While there's little doubt about his skill, one wonders how long he'll continue wrestling with rock at all.
I've played Station to Station on numerous occasions on the radio, but I did open the show when Davey passed away and I had to do that show on the Monday night.
Yeah.
I started with Station to Station. It's a euphoric song, not particularly in that surround, but yeah, it's absolutely joyous in a very dark and sinister way, albeit. Circus Magazine declared Station to Station offers cryptic glimpses that let us feel the contours and palpitations of the masquer's soul, but never fully reveal his face. It finishes by saying that it shows Bowie pulling out his most challenging leg of his winding journey. With the Station to Station sessions completed in December 1975, Bowie started work on the soundtrack for The Man Who Fell to Earth with Paul Buckmaster as his collaborator. Bowie expected to be wholly responsible for the film's music, but found that when I'd finished 5 or 6 pieces, I was then told that if I would care to submit my music along with some other people's, I just said, shit, you're not getting any of it. I was so furious, I'd put so much work into it.
Wow, yeah, we can understand that, can't you?
We said earlier on that he'd recommended John Phillips to
That's
do it
right.
as well, so it's a little bit conflicting, these stories.
Yeah, but unless he started and thought, oh, I just can't be bothered with this.
Right.
And then thought, oh, you know, I'll suggest somebody instead. Anyway, notwithstanding that, Harry Maslin argued that Bowie was burned out and could not complete the work in any case. The singer eventually collapsed, admitting later, there were pieces of me lying all over the floor. In the event, only one instrumental composed for the soundtrack saw the light of day, evolving into Subterraneans on the next studio album, Low. And after the album was finished, Bowie hastily arranged a satellite interview with English talk show host Russell Harty. CR, we've done that, haven't we, in depth, to announce that his retirement was over. He had a new record and he'd be setting off on a 6-month world tour, which brings us to, well, Station to Station Tour, or the Isolar Tour, or what became known as the White Light Tour.
Yeah, so after abandoning the soundtrack album, Bowie went on tour in support of Station to Station, beginning on the 2nd of February 1976 at the Pacific Coliseum, Vancouver, and continuing through North America and Europe, concluding at the Pavilion de Paris in Paris, France, on the 18th of May 1976.
Now, Kraftwerk's Radioactivity was used as an overture to the shows, alongside footage from Louis Buñuel's and Salvador Dali's surrealist film Unchained and the Lou. The visual element of the performances incorporated banks of fluorescent white light set against black backdrops, creating a stark spectacle on the stage, largely devoid of props or other visual distractions. This is what led to it being known as the White Light Tour.
Legendary. The stadium featured Bowie dressed in the Duke's usual black waistcoat and trousers, a pack of Gitanes placed self-consciously in his pocket, moving stiffly among curtains of white light.
Ooh.
We've talked about this, haven't we? About the image that he had, and suggesting that he got it from some waiters in Germany.
Also, he hadn't been to see Judi Dench in a play in London, I think.
That's right, yeah.
Anyway, during the tour, Bowie told Melody Maker's Chris Welsh about his ideas behind the stage show and set design. He said, I think it looks like a corrupted version of the 30s German theatre, what with the waistcoat, which has always been a favourite of mine. I should have a watch chain to make it perfect. I'm trying to put over the idea of the European movement with the Dali film and playing Kraftwerk over the speakers. I'd like to get my hands on the new Eno album to play, actually. I think side one is absolutely fabulous.
Great. In 1989, Bowie reflected, I wanted to go back to a kind of expressionist German film look and the lighting of, say, Fritz Lang or Pabst, a black and white movies look, but with the intensity that was sort of aggressive. I think for me, personally, theatrically, that was the most successful tour I've ever done. I don't know if it was kind of just because it wasn't as ambitious as before.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that the Diamond Dogs, Philly Dogs, all that was it had its headaches, didn't it?
Yeah, of course.
The cherry
did, yeah.
Pickers and all that. I mean,
yeah.
The more gizmos you have, the more gizmos can go wrong. And so
if
a fluorescent light bulb goes out, you can whip to B&Q and get
one. Yeah, even I could do that, yeah.
I mean, it would have been handy if the Hard Rock that Davey Bowie opened in 1972 in Manchester, we eventually turned into a B&Q. It would have been handy if Bowie could have popped in and done both things at the same time.
Absolutely perfect.
Absolutely perfect. So after what he later described as a falling out due to a misunderstanding with Bowie's management team, Station to Station guitarist Earl Slick didn't play on the tour. In his place, Bowie hired an unknown 21-year-old Canadian, Stacey Hayden. Pianist Roy Britton couldn't make it either, so Bowie brought in Yes keyboardist Tony Kaye. This is ironic. So Tony Kaye left Yes right? And so David Bowie, at the same point in time, asked Rick Wakeman to join the Spiders. He said, no, I can't do it because I'm going to go and join Yes.
Ooh.
So if Tony Kaye had stayed put, things would have been so very, very different.
Very, very much indeed. So the band that Bowie used for the White Light Tour was known as Raw Moon occasionally, wasn't it?
I didn't know that.
Right, okay. So obviously it's Bowie on vocals and sax.
Carlos Alomar, rhythm guitar.
Stacey Hayden, lead guitar.
George Murray, bass guitar.
Dennis Davis on drums.
And yes, Tony Kaye on keyboards.
Now, on a handful of US dates, the set list included Sister Midnight, which is a new song written with Iggy Pop and Carlos Alomar, which wouldn't see light of day until it appeared on The Idiot a year later. And the Isolar Tour was the source, and one of the artist's best-known bootlegs, which was from an FM radio broadcast of his March 76 gig at Nassau Coliseum. Live album was eventually released years later.
3 days before he played the Nassau Column, which was recorded and broadcast on the King Biscuit Flower Hour, and Bowie's hotel room in Rochester was raided by police. He, Iggy Pop, and two companions were arrested on suspicion of possessing marijuana, but the case never came to trial. So this has given us what everybody does regard, who's ever seen it and particularly likes Bowie, as the coolest ever mugshot in the history of mankind, isn't it?
When you look at mugshots, traditionally, everybody looks guilty, whether they are or not, don't they? But Bowie looks the epitome of cool. It's such a great look, just staring straight back at the lens.
It could have been an album cover.
Yeah. I'm sure he considered it at one point. Anyway, other incidents on the Isolar tour attracted publicity. When the tour reached Berlin in April 76, there were rumours that Bowie had been photographed outside Hitler's bunker. Then, after travelling with Iggy Pop, his possessions were searched by officials at the Russian-Finnish border, and books on Albert Speer and Joseph Goebbels were confiscated, and the local press started to suggest that Bowie was a collector of Nazi memorabilia.
So the same month, he was quoted at a press conference in Stockholm as saying that Britain could benefit from a fascist leader. Bowie would blame his addictions and the persona of the Thin White Duke for his lapses in judgment. The controversy culminated on the 2nd of May 1976, shortly before the tour completed, in the so-called Victoria Station incident in London, when Bowie arrived in an open-top Mercedes convertible and was reported to have given a Nazi salute to the crowd. We've talked about this.
We have.
He was waving.
He was.
And they caught him mid-wave. And, but, you know, all the other stuff around it is probably inarguable. So
yeah.
It's not us trying to whitewash this.
No, but... It was a midwave, definitely.
Yeah.
And one of his one of the people who stuck up for him was a young Gary Newman, who was among the crowd at the station that day. He said, think about it. If a photographer takes a whole motor-driven film of somebody doing a wave, you will get a Nazi salute at the end of each arm sweep. All you need is some dickhead at a music paper or whatever to make an issue out of it.
And pretty generous as well from Gary Newman, who, have you interviewed him?
I have a few times. Yeah, he's the sweetest guy. He's terrific.
He's really, really great. But it is the story that we have told before on the Kenny Everett show, was that they were supposed to both be on the same episode of Kenny Everett, and Gary Newman was there watching Bowie at the invite of the, it was David Mallet, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was David, video director, yeah.
Yeah, and he was producing and directing the programme, and he invited Gary Newman to come and watch Bowie because he knew he was such a big fan, and Bowie saw Gary Newman and got him kicked out.
Yeah, he did.
So he's pretty generous of old Gaz to step in there on Bowie's behalf.
Yeah.
The stigma remained, however, to the extent that the lines, to be insulted by these fascists, it's so degrading. From Scary Monsters' opening track, It's No Game, 4 years later, were interpreted as an attempt to bury the incident once and for all.
So the tour got to Wembley for a six-night run in May 76. And you were there at Wembley, weren't you?
Oh, I was, mate.
With Steve Hanley, sat in front of the boxer, John Canty, who was world champion for a time, probably at that time, and you were in front of him.
Yeah, well, it was actually me, Steve Hanley, and a guy called Andy Greenwood, who was a mate of ours at that point in time. And I had to ring Steve Hanley because he's got a memory, and I haven't. And he reminded me, what happened is we got the bus from Chorlton Street bus station in Manchester to Victoria in London. We got the tube from Victoria to Seven Sisters, where his Auntie Phyllis lived.
Right.
We went to Auntie Phyllis's house and Uncle Pat. We went over there, said our hellos, got the tube then to Wembley.
Right.
Hoofed on over to the Empire Pool. On the way over, we bought some Bowie lights.
Right.
Now, I think they still crop up every now and then at gigs.
Right.
But they are just like little... It looks like nuclear fluid.
Yes, I'm with you. Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean.
It's just bright green liquid in a little phial.
Yeah.
Okay, and what you had to do was crack it, and then it would glow.
Yeah.
So it's a glow stick. music. And so you would take it in and they were Bowie light. So you had Bowie light written on it, as I remember.
Wow.
And the idea being that you would use it on the night, but crucially, you see, the big sales point, if you took it home and put it in the fridge, it would rejuvenate.
Really? Is that
so?
No.
Yeah.
It was
supposed
to. Right.
Of course, everybody tried it, but it didn't work. But what are you going to do? I mean, you're not going to crack it, find a fridge, stick it in before the gig, and then go back to the bloke who sold it to you for however much and say, it doesn't work, mate.
It's false advertising, that really is.
But it worked on the night. And as you say, we had rubbish seats. Now, Craig Scanlon, who, like Steve Hanley, lots of other people, let's face it, ended up in the fall.
Yeah.
Craig went on a different night and he had a great seat. But Steve Hanley and I and Andy Greenwood, we were on the back tier of Wembley, and it was indeed John Conte sat behind us. You would have thought he'd be able to pull some other strings, really. Yeah.
Right.
But the show was amazing. And as you say, Unchi and Andy Lou was on beforehand, and the music that was played, though we didn't know, was Kraftwerk. I was very far away from Bowie. And there weren't any theatrics. I was hoping for the odd cherry picker here and there.
Right.
There was a little bit of disappointment, if I'm dead honest, just in that element. And then at the end of the show, we went back to Seven Sisters, stayed with Auntie Phyllis and Uncle Pat, and then got the bus back home again. But I was, to be fair, I was only 15 at the time.
Yeah,
so,
enough.
You know, a fair play to me folks for letting me go. Though I think that it would have taken wild horses and some handcuffs to keep me from going.
Yeah, I'm seriously jealous. You know what? When you read about the reviews, contemporary reviews of the show, or even kind of later on, a lot of people talk about Bowie being aloof and being very kind of icy, a little bit cold and lacking in emotion. But at the same time, you know, I've talked to people who were there and they said, well, it wasn't like that at all. It was a really kind of uplifting thing. And Bowie was doing a lot of his dance moves and all that kind of thing. So it's almost like in retrospect, that's seen as this as a very, very kind of cold, almost forbidding live show.
Well, I did find it a little bit like the latter. But then again, I suppose, you know, I mean, I've been looking at photographs of Bowie. I've been looking at videos when, as we mentioned before, we didn't have them to hand, did we? We didn't have
no,
YouTube.
No, of
so
course not.
Whenever you saw Bowie performing, it was just, you know, your lapped up cracked actor.
Yeah.
You know, you lapped up any Top of the Pops performance or one that would get repeated. So I was kind of in my mind and seeing cracked actor expecting this kind of shimmying guy with a couple of props. But he was stalking the stage. On the night that I saw him, he was largely stalking the stage. He was throwing a few little moves.
Right.
Which I believe is supposed to be the same kind of dance that Ian Curtis stole for his own routine, for want of a better word, with Joy Division.
Yeah.
You know, so he's got his fist clenched and he just a little shimmy of the shoulders.
Yeah.
There was a bit of that going on, but I mean, you know, he wasn't Fred Astaire on the not on the night.
No, I'm with you. Okay.
That I was there.
I suppose you're right, though. You would be having sort of absorbed Bowie and seeing all the videos and pictures and the rest of it, but you know, you'd be expecting loads of colour and flash, wouldn't you? And especially people on stage as well that you would recognise.
Do you know what? Even at that point in time, I did think it was Earl Slick. I didn't know that Stacey Hayden, and I got the magazine, so I think he might be mentioned in the magazine, the actual players.
Yeah.
But I was expecting Earl Slick to be there, but he didn't really have a foil like Ronno.
No,
you know,
not.
Or even Earl Slick as you're looking at him playing. But of course, the Diamond Dogs tour, all the musicians were supposed to be behind the scenes anyway, weren't they?
Yeah, there you go. So the legacy, Bowie himself has said of Station to Station, as far as the music goes, Low and its siblings were a direct follow-on from the title track, whilst Brian Eno opined that Low was very much a continuation from Station to Station. It was also influential on post-punk. Roy Carr and Charles Shaw Murray, again writing in 1981, said if Low was Gary Newman's Bowie album, then Station to Station was Magazine's.
Yeah, very true. I mean, Magazine were hugely influenced by Bowie and Roxy Music, perhaps even more.
Mm.
But anyway, more than 20 years after its release, Bowie considered both Station to Station and Low great, damn good albums. But due to his disconnected state during its recording, listened to Station to Station as a piece of work by an entirely different person.
Bowie explained further. He said, first, there's a content, which nobody's actually been terribly clear about. The Station to Station track itself is very much concerned with the Stations of the Cross, as we mentioned. All the references within the piece are to do with the Kabbalah. It's the nearest album to a magic treatise that I've written. I've never read a review that really sussed it. It's an extremely dark album. Miserable time to live through, I must say.
In 1999, music biographer David Buckley, hello David, described Station to Station as a masterpiece of invention that some critics would argue, perhaps unfashionably, is his finest record. The same year, Eno called it one of the great records of all time. We've discussed before. Yeah. I mean, my favourite Bowie albums do change. Sometimes it's a man who sold the world, you know.
Right, yeah.
But Young Americans is usually at the top there. Mm. But on occasions, it's Station to Station. Yeah. It is one of his finest moments for me.
No doubt about it.
Following his three Los Angeles arena shows in February 1976, Bowie packed up his house in Bel Air and moved back to Europe. First to Switzerland, Charlie Chaplin and Roger Moore's his neighbours.
Yes.
And then to Berlin.
Yeah, CB for all that stuff. I haven't a clue where I'm going to be in a year, said Bowie after Station to Station was released in January 76. A raving nut, a flower child or a dictator, some kind of reverend. I don't know. That's what keeps me from getting bored.
So that's it for this episode of the A to Z of David Bowie. But once again, before you go,
if you'd like to support us along the way and be a member of an exclusive Bowie club, you can, and here's how.
There's an exclusive Bowie members club called Cheap Things, and for just $5 a month, wow, you can be part of it.
Why? So now you're thinking $5 isn't much, but what exactly will I get for my hard-earned cash?
Well, in short, you'll get lots of great new exclusive material delivered to your door.
Well, computer, actually, Mark.
Via a system called Patreon.
That's right, Mark. Patreon is a payment system that allows you to contribute your monthly subscription and offers you a portal to access the exclusive material.
Material such as
interviews with Bowie's cohorts and friends.
There'll be regular film Bowie quizzes.
Bowie guitar tutorials.
Unreleased archive written material.
Competitions.
And perhaps most impressively, short films featuring the Cheap Things team.
Ah, that'll be me, Mark, Howard Knock and Jason Reed.
Visiting various Bowie places of interest.
And much more besides.
All this for just $5 a month.
So if you can't resist, simply go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/cheapthings, or one word, and join up.
There's also a website,
BowieCheapThings.com.
Book early.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.